Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Pinnell. Only on Talk.
Talk Radio is listening to Writer's Block. I am your host, Jim Christina, and I'm sitting here looking at the lovely, charming, vivacious, quirky Miss Bobby Jean Bell, and of course, Mr. Richard Polidelli out there in Fruta, Idaho, or Colorado.
I moved again.
I know. So anyway, hi guys, how are you?
Hey. We're good. I'm good.
Okay. I'm just hanging out uncomfortably close to the Utah state line, but I'm here.
Uncomfortably close is always good as long as you're not over the state line.
Yeah.
Because you're still wanted there, Richard.
Yeah, I don't think the statute of limitations has run yet.
I don't think so either. You know, our opening music is written by a real good old friend of mine. Well, a real good old friend of mine, Rick Gilman. And we've been friends for like 40 years. And he generously donated this song for our show. But a funny thing about Rick is that when he plays in bare feet. And we used to call him the barefoot troubadour. And we used to play at the Engine House number 9 in Tacoma a lot. And he used to pull his shoes off. I would say, Gilman, put your shoes back on. No. No barefoot here. No shirt, no shoes, no service. No shirt, no shoes, no playing.
Yeah.
Anyway, we got a great show for it tonight. I'm all the Twitter again over this book. This book was like so much fun to read and so fast. I just went ripped through it. It was just like, wow. The hero in this book is almost like a James Bond, and I'm sure that you guys will agree with me. He's like a multifaceted and he goes everything. He just does everything.
He's an action hero.
He's like a G.I. Joe only in real life. Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's bring in the author, because I have to say that he is like, oh, wow. Well, without any further ado, let's bring in his author of, I think this is the seventh book.
Number six for
Will Parker. Please welcome to the Writer's Block, Mr. Anderson Harp. Hello, Andy. How are you?
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's truly our pleasure. And this book was so much fun. Gosh. A lot of flying in it. A lot of pretty much everything. Jungle stuff and AK-47s and Heckler and Koch pistols. And this guy was like, he's like James Bond, only he's a U.S. guy.
We'll take that. Yeah, we will take that. He is a bit of a complex figure, going back to the first novel.
Right.
In the first novel, Northern Thunder, which was involved with a North Korean scenario. What drove him to come out of the civilian world to go back into special operations was that his parents were on the Lockerbie flight that were killed, Pan Am Flight 103. So that gave him a lot of fire to start into adventures around the world. So but he's got another talent too that's sort of unusual, and that is he is a natural multilinguist. He can go anywhere and speak any language, even with the accent of the locals talk. So that really is a weapon in today's world, if you were able to have accomplished language.
Well, I noticed that one of the captives, Chuck, as they're he's trying to pick up the language, and he says, okay, let's learn the language. And so he's listening to them and picking up phrases and picking up stuff as he goes, which is how natural linguists do it.
Yeah. And, that's a good point you really picked up on.
And we had an FBI agent on here that was also had gone through the Monterey Language School. And that was one of her points, too, is that they pick you up. They dump you into small phrases and words. And those you pick up and you just keep building on that. And I mean, you know, as a kid, we learned Italian. Well, as self-defense, we learned Italian. But you know, if your mother and father is screaming and your name is mentioned, you better know what they're screaming about. Yeah. But
one of the other observations that's sort of interesting is that how you translate that into cinema now. You know, because when the first novel came back, you would say, how do you project a multilinguist spy?
Right.
And you think about James Bond is very vanilla. He really doesn't get into that stuff. I mean, he's just a, you know, fight scene after fight scene. But, you know, there's been such a success of these international movies where people actually will watch movies and they may have subtitles now. And a lot of people don't even think about the subtitles because the spy is so intriguing.
Right.
And they just follow along with the storyline.
You know, I speaking of linguists and language and picking up languages, I think one of the best examples of picking up a language as they go was it's an older movie. It's Anthony Banderas and it's The 13th Warrior. If you've seen the movie, if you remember when he's first hooked up with the Vikings and he's traveling, he's listening to them talk every night around the campfire. And little by little, he's picking up their language.
Right.
Until somebody calls his mother a whore, and he goes, "You will not talk to my mother that way. My mother was a saint." And everybody looks at him like, what? How did you learn a language? I listened.
You stepped over the line, and I know it.
Exactly.
I'll tell you what, too. Just as a practical matter, in this new world that we live in, now the Marine Corps requires language skills early on.
They actually
will put you into a pipeline where if you study French, you know, at the younger ranks, private, lance corporal, basic language skills. But if you study French, then you're earmarked for service in Africa, for example. And of course, Chinese and Russia, you know, Russian, you know, you're earmarked to different parts of the world. Of course, Arabic would be something that if you do Arabic on your record, you're probably going to get a lot of active duty in the Marine Corps right now or any of the services.
Right. Well, if you have Italian there, they're going to put you in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Okay. What if you know Klingon? Where do you go? I mean, come on.
Yeah. The Enterprise. So, Bobby, I know that you're chomping. I know you got questions, so let them rip.
Well, welcome. We're happy to have you. Why don't you tell us the title of the book that we're talking about tonight? And just a real quick little backstory about where it happens. And, you know, just give us the little elevator pitch so we know what we're talking about.
Sure, Bobby. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's got an unusual title, but it's a very practical title. November 400 CP is missing. You know, I'm a pilot, and of course, my character is a pilot. And November 400 is a call designation or a designation for an aircraft. Right. I think actually November means it's a U.S.-based aircraft. And really, the way the story starts is Will Parker really sort of become bored in life, so to speak, and being a pilot and having all this history in the past, he travels to and lives in Alaska, where he flies rescue missions for folks that get caught on a mountain or get caught in the backcountry. But he's also the guy that when he was in the Marine Corps, he was a member of a unit called the Air Naval Gunfire Liaison Company, which was a small team that would be dropped well behind enemy lines and would call naval fire, air fire, something like that. But he had a small team that he lived with that is his band of brothers, and they followed him on. And he sort of became the guy that when the government failed and it involved a Marine that was hurt, injured, or missing, then a family member might, as in this case, came to him. There was a Marine that served with Chevron in the Malaysia, Indonesia world. And the aircraft followed the same type of lines as the Airbus that disappeared, Malaysian Airlines disappeared, Flight 370, and it disappeared off the scope. And Will Parker's asked by the widow to see if she can find out what happened to her husband. So he's called forth to go to that part of the world. And it is a very interesting and very volatile world. That Malaysia, I think, is 97% Muslim, and it has a history that goes back for 1,000 years. Banda Aceh is the capital in the north end of the island, and Banda Aceh used to be called the gateway to the pilgrimages to Mecca, because all the Western Pacific Muslims would go through Banda Aceh for literally hundreds and hundreds of years. So it's a powder keg. And then you put on top of that the geographic aspects of it. It's a very volatile area. It's probably one of the most volatile earthquake areas in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So you put all that chemistry together, and you have somebody that's going into a strange world to try to find answers out to what happened to this particular person.
Okay. We'll stick with that.
And it is fast-paced.
It is fast-paced. And, you know, amazingly, I spent 4 years when I was a kid in the Philippine Islands. And, you know, most of the southern islands in the Philippines are Muslim.
Yes.
Out of 7,000 islands, like, I think three are Catholic. And the rest are pretty much are Muslim or Hindu, amazingly enough.
Right.
Which is amazing. Which is amazing to me as a kid. Because I none of that I understood, but now I do. But then I said, well, so what's the difference, you know?
Sure, Malaysia, Indonesia's like that too. I mean,
right.
One country can be, Sumatra can be 97% Muslim, and another part can be, like you say, Hindu. So, I mean, each of these little countries that are packed in together, island countries packed in together, have all these different religious viewpoints.
Right.
So you just really have a lot of volatile circumstances that makes for a good thriller.
Right. And your evil antagonist wanted everybody to be Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've heard that one before, I think.
He was a piece of work, I have to say. He was a piece of work. He just didn't care. If you weren't Muslim,
it's always a challenge.
You were a piece of meat.
To create a bad guy. You know, how do you create a bad guy that is multifaceted? Mm-hmm. And I think one of my friends, I think it was David Morrell, who was talking about one time. We were talking about the fact that the bad guy has to really believe in what he is doing.
Exactly.
He is righteous. And I mean, that's what you try to project on the pages.
Right.
Those are probably the most scariest bad guys that we have in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Aren't they fun to write though? Bad guys. I love writing bad guys. I absolutely love writing bad guys.
So I understand actors always say that they love to play the part of the bad guy in movies. It's the ones that they prefer.
Yeah. Richard, you got something?
Oh yeah, I do. I'm just waiting for you guys to sort that out. I'm trying to remember where I read this, but it was talking about the villains, is that everyone is the hero in their own story. Mm-hmm. And a person says, well, what about the villains? And the reply is, especially the villains.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing as a writer, you got to walk in here thinking the bad guy just can't be a bad guy because he's a bad guy and you need him to be a bad guy.
Right.
He has to he has to have something that he's trying to accomplish, whether we would say it's good or bad or whatever. So that is kind of the challenge.
Or it's simply revenge, killing Mercury, which is what preceding novels. The guy came from Yemen, and his family was decimated by a drone strike, and so he wanted to wreak revenge.
Yeah.
So I mean, you're right about that. If you know, a good villain is a fairly complicated person.
Well, the best villain book or movies that I came across was in the movie The Rock. And it was the general played by Ed Harris. And he had stolen this chemical weapon, was threatening to use it on San Francisco. But his reason was, in a way, just. He was trying to get justice for his men who had been killed, and the government wasn't acknowledging it. They weren't giving benefits to the family. So this was a villain I thought was the perfect villain. He's a bad guy, but he's got a just cause. And that's kind of something I kept with me when I write villains. I try to give them something that you can kind of say, okay, I can see why he's doing it, even though it's wrong.
And that's so much fun about being with you guys, is being with fellow writers. You really get a sense of the feel of things. I had a friend that I knew from years ago that his father wrote one of the most successful books of all times in the United States. It was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for 18 months. Then it was an enormous Broadway play, and then it was made into a successful movie. And he came out of a small town in Georgia, and he wrote this book and had all of his success at the age of 32, and he died shortly thereafter. After the success of this book, he would have on his front porch, he would have all these successful writers that came down, sat on his front porch and talked about writing. And it was, the book was No Time for Sergeants by Mack Hyman. And he'd have people like Herman Wook would come down and sit on the porch and they'd talk about writing. Huh. So, I mean, there's a real, real fun conversation of writers to writers, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Hey, Tuff, for just a minute, Andy, we're going to be right back with you, so don't go away and don't hang up. And you are listening to LA Talk Radio. This, of course, is the Writer's Block. We will be right back after these brief words from LA Talk Radio.
Hi, Jim Christina here for LA Talk Radio. You know, it seems everyone has a podcast these days, so how about you do this? How about you start your very own radio show that goes out live worldwide for nary a pittance? If you think you have an idea that would translate to a radio talk format, then stop waiting. Go to www.latalkradio.com. Click on the link that says Become a Host. Follow the easy instructions, and before you know it, you'll be the on-air live host of your very own talk show on LA Talk Radio. We have 50-minute slots available every day, including Sundays, so don't be shy. Join the many that have started their careers on the air. Join the hosts on LA Talk Radio at www.latalkradio.com.
And we are back with our guest tonight, and we are with Mr. Anderson Harp, and we're talking about his new book about the Earth. I can't even remember the title. It's N 400 something is missing. Anyway, flying military helicopters had just numbers. There was, you know, military helicopters, especially Army, only had numbers and didn't have any N, nothing. It just like was 311545 was my helicopter tail number. So it's just like, N but is like.
I'll tell you, Jim, the beauty of that is, you know, when I've done other titles and my editor would say, well, that title has already been taken. You don't see a lot of November 400 CP is missing out there on Amazon.
That's true. That, you don't. Anyway, if you want to call and talk to Andy Harp tonight, the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And you can call and you can actually talk to him live and not on Memorex. And Bobby Jean, 1, 2, 3, go.
I have a question. Reading this book, I discovered I actually began kind of keeping a list of characters' names because there are quite a few and there are a number of plot lines, and I would get kind of confused about who belonged to which plot line and how are they all going to meet up at the end. And I noticed that some characters you chose not to give them a name, even though they may appear frequently in the book. And I'll just give an example of there's two young, kind of young soldiers on the sort of on the, you know, the negative side that are always playing video games, and you never name them, but we get some backstory on them. And I just thought it was interesting. Can you share a little bit about how you decide to name a character, not name a character? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, Bobby, that's an excellent point. I was talking to, I've been a member of the International Swirl Writers for years and was at a round table with a couple authors. And one of them was saying, well, when I try to write a thriller, I don't name more than six characters in my book, which is a really interesting challenge to do. But the idea is that if you name the character, then you vest the reader in that character. So if you try to not name the character, then that character might bring something to the story, but the reader doesn't really vest in that person, is the idea of it. So you try to direct the reader towards the named characters as the one that you want to invest the most interest in. So that's why we did that. And you're right. It's hard. Sometimes it's hard to pull back from that in the sense that you probably say, well, geez, what more do I want to know about this character? But I'm trying to really sort of move you along to other characters. And like you say, I try to do multiple plot lines to converge at the end, which I think is the fun part about it. You know, you can see these different lines tracking along, and you know or suspect at some point in time they're going to collide together. And that's really the intent of the novel, is how you collide them. Mm-hmm. And how you also put a hook into the collision as well, which is nice, and which is why I've tried to done several of my books, which there's something that in the beginning of the book that may be subtle, and then at the end of the book it goes off like a hand grenade.
Right. And you did something in this book that I don't know that we're used to seeing, but possibly, is that you never really describe Will Parker. And this is the first book of yours that I've read, but I'm going to guess that you never really, in all of your books, really describe him. You're giving the reader a chance to bring up his own face and the way he looks to the reader. Am I close?
I'd say so. Although I'd say there's probably some more descriptions early on in probably the first book, which really, this was similar to Joseph Campbell type of the hero's journey. Mm-hmm. He started out as a district attorney in the South, prosecuting a lot of heavy drug trials. And he had been this well-decorated Marine in the past. And circumstance had pulled him out of that into this other situation. And like I said, as I mentioned earlier, the driving point that sort of caused him to abandon that whole normal world, so to speak, of being a district attorney was the loss of his parents. So that sort of pulled him into this other world. And so he was probably described more so in the early ones, but like I say, it's also sort of fun for the reader to not have all the answers to the questions. You know, let the reader imagine what the character is, physically or otherwise.
Right. Because my idea of what he looked like was like about 5'10", 5'11", steely gray hair, a scar on his cheek, wiry as hell.
You just described me. My wife would not agree with that, but I'll just
you can get away with that. We can't see you.
Yeah. Now we know why the Skype didn't work, don't we?
Yeah. Well, the thriller writer has to keep some mystery about things.
Well, of course. But everybody has their ideas. And I think that's a mark of it. I think a writer that really cares about his audience, because you're giving us the opportunity to make our own description of what the hero looks like.
And I think that's probably for the younger writers that listen, that is probably the mistake that's made, is filling in all the blanks.
Over describing. We talk about that every single week about over descriptions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I've seen younger readers who have jumped in and said, you know, I do the same thing. I don't get overly descriptive with my characters because I want the reader to jump in. And this is a way to connect with the story. But I've had younger readers who will tell me, you know, you need to tell us more about what the person looks like or what this looks like. It's like, no, I'm giving you a general description. I'm letting you fill in the blanks so that you connect with the story, and they don't get that.
Right.
And I'm not really sure why.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
They don't have imagination.
Exactly. And, you know, I think if you're good at what you do, and you are definitely good at what you do, is that a lot of your dialogue will describe your character as well. It will bring up points of your character that you haven't described, but it can help describe who he is. So,
audiences are so different. I was listening to your interview with J.P. McLean. She made the passing comment about she appreciated your liking her work, because when she got a 1-star, you know, she'd remember it. I don't know if you recall that.
Yeah.
Anyway,
that reminded me that early on, I got a review from Goodreads, and it was a 2-star. And, you know, I think I put a lot of work in this, a year of work. This is like a child of mine. And, you know, what does the person think about doing a 2-star? So I looked up the person's reviews, and I saw that person also gave a 2-star to Kill a Mockingbird and two or three other classics. You know, so when you see these 1-star, 2-stars, 3-stars, you know, the system doesn't let you realize, you know, the parameters of the person that's giving that critique, so to speak. But I thought that was funny that she mentioned that.
Well,
some people moronic behavior.
That's true. The one thing that drives me crazy with Goodreads is you'll get somebody will come along and they'll say, you know, it's a 3-star review because the book was too long. The very next review comes along and it's maybe it's a 2-star. This book wasn't long enough. It's like, well, I don't know what the hell to do then. You know?
Exactly. Exactly. I made the mistake one time at taking golf lessons, and I thought it was the great writer's guiding lesson. Is I took these lessons for about 4 or 5 days, and beat that little sucker all day long with my instructor, and he told me to do that, and he told me to do that, and he said this is the way you approach, and this is the way you do that, and then he at the end of that it all he said, all right, I got one more lesson for you. I said, okay, great. What's the golden rule? What's the lesson of lessons? He said, forget everything I told you and just go play golf.
There you go.
Here's my advice. Writing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Here's my advice. Get rid of the golf clubs. Take up tennis.
Yeah. Burn them. I think I burned mine, but yeah.
Let's switch gears here a little bit, because your writing style is really, really, really well done. When do you like to write? What is your process? Do you like to write in the morning, in the evening, in the afternoons? Do you have a certain page count or word count you like to get done during the day, or does it really matter?
Well, actually, I do a lot of research, months of research on locations and characters, and even the sense of smell and sight and sound. I mean, my books are intended to be very visual. So there's a lot of background research. And then when I get into it, then I've got a quiet place that I go to, and I'll start pounding out the pages. And generally we'll start at 6 or 7 in the morning and go to some stopping point. You know, it really is like a rolling roller coaster. It really is a ride that you get, uh-huh. get into it and get into a rhythm. And, you know, one of the worst things about it is something breaks you off of your rhythm. You know, if life takes you away from something that you're on chapter 15, that really is difficult to spin the engine back up.
Right.
But the way I do that would be just to start pulling out where I am and reread the book, the manuscript from page 1 right up to chapter 15, and then I can jump back in. But I'll do it, like I say, in, I will try to write, you know, what may be several weeks, starting at 6 a.m, sometimes going until mid-afternoon. One time I was on a roll and I wrote 7,500 words in a day, which is a long day of creative writing.
That is a long day.
Yeah.
That's like a quarter of a book almost, you know. Well,
yeah, that's a challenge. It is a challenge. But then you know, the other thing too, I say particularly for the young writers out there that are listening is that, I was with John Gresham one time at a plumbing stop. He afterwards, or to people afterwards, because he made the comment. He said, you know, once I finish a book, I'm done with the book. And I think what he's referencing is, you know, the thing that you didn't see coming at you till you really got into this world is the edits and re-edits.
Right.
And you go through, you know, several edits and re-edits.
Yep.
You know, or they call you, New York calls you up and said, the guy that you have on page on chapter 7, you killed off, reappears on chapter 14.
Right.
What are you going to do about it?
Right. Oops. Right. Well, and, you know, Richard and I know this as well. And, you know, by the time you get done with the book, you've read it 52 times. Yep. You know, and after it's published and you pick up a book and you, 6 months later, you can pick up your book and open the page, and the first thing you see is an error. Mm-hmm. And you go, Jesus, yeah. How did that happen? Go ahead, Bobby.
My condolence to that is, that, you know, if you reread the Bible, you'll probably find several errors.
Yeah.
I have a question. You obviously are an international traveler. I would imagine some of that has come from your career, and you weave travel into these books. If you were giving some advice to somebody who is sitting down and really wants to write a thriller, I have two questions, I guess. Can you tell us a little bit about it? What are some really important components that a thriller must have in it? And then how do you bring your travels in if you've never been places? Are you using Google Maps, or, you know, how do you research the travel pieces for a thriller?
Good question.
Yeah, that's really a good question. Yeah, that's a good question. And I think I have an interesting answer to that. You're right. I have done a lot of travel. One of the things that I had the chance to do was create something called Operation Thriller. So we, with the USO, I took myself and several other authors, on USO tours to the Persian Gulf, and then a friend of mine took him to Afghanistan. So that, in addition to my military experience, gave me exposure to a lot of places that you would not go to, you know, on your typical vacation, so to speak. So that, you know, that's a travel opportunity I particularly had, which it sort of pulls into the storyline. But the other interesting thing is, of course, there are places that I have not been, nor can I be. And the best example of that is in this first book, Northern Thunder. I was trying to figure out how to really describe Phnom Penh with some degree of accuracy. And in my research, I found a Russian student who had spent a summer in North Korea, and he had a journal, and he described the day-to-day life associated of living in North Korea. And that was just a treasure trove of information. So you couple the travel experience also with, like I say, there's so much research capable nowadays with, like I say, with Google and everything like that, that you can, and if you Google Map, you can go just about anywhere in the world, jot down on it. Although it's interesting where there's some places that are blocked out by Google Map.
Right. We're going to have to cut it right there for just a minute. And we're going to have to go to another commercial, but we'll be right back with you in just a minute. You're listening to LA Talk Radio. This is The Writer's Block. And we will be right back after a brief word from Black Dog Publishing and Tuscany Bay Books.
Congratulations, you finally finished that book. Now what are you going to do with it? Well, as a new writer, you probably do what all new writers do, stick it in the drawer with the other 6 or 7. Well, why not this time do something a little different? Why not get a hold of Black Dog Publishing and our fine imprint of Tuscany Bay Books? See, we can get that book out of the drawer. We can proofread it. We can edit it. We can format it. We can publish it. We can print it. We can copyright it, and we can get it on the shelf so your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, hell, even a person you don't know or two or three might want to buy a copy. It's all what it's about. And all of this for less than the cost of your firstborn. So why not give us a shot? BlackDogPublishing.co, TuscanyBayBooks.com, your answer to getting your book published, and right now we're probably the best at what we do in this industry. Black Dog Publishing, Tuscany Bay Books.
And for boutique publishers, I don't think you can go wrong, eh, Richard?
Nope, no, sure can't. Sure can't.
That's right.
You might want to hurry up and call us before rising prices make it your firstborn.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. And you, of course, are listening to LA Talk Radio. We're on the air with Mr. Andy Harp, whose latest book is a thriller about Malaysia and Sumatra and Myanmar and that whole archipelago down there. The world, yeah. And you can call and talk to Andy if you'd like. And the number here in the studio is 323-203-0815. And if you want to call and talk to him about anything, or you can talk to Bobby Jean, or you can talk to Richard, or why anybody would want to talk to me, I have no idea, but, you know, they could do that too. Okay. I'm going to ask you the question early, only because you partially answered it already before the break. This, of course, is called the writer's block. Have you had writer's block? And if you have, how did you get out of it? And if you hadn't, how come?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess, in a way, so I referenced it earlier, per se, writer's block, a blank page. I really haven't had that type of issue, except that when I'm writing a book and I get into it, I get into the rhythm of the book, and then something pulls me away from it. And then coming back, when I first look at that next blank page, I get writer's block. But then, like I say, the cure for that is I will go back to the beginning of that manuscript and reread it and sort of pick up the rhythm of the piece and be able to take it on from there. You know, another aspect of it is my publishing house wanted me to do outlines early on about the books. But I would do sometimes, last couple of books, I did very detailed outlines that even include dialogue, which is, you know, it's a laborious task to do an outline like that. But at the same time, it also helps, you know, writer's block, the risk of writer block later on, until you can just jump right into where you got pulled away from it.
Right. Well, we, you know, we deal with a lot of writers who do outlines, and then we also deal with a lot of writers who are pantsers. And
right.
You know, they all pretty much the same thing, is I know how the book's going to start, I know how the book's going to end, and I'm just never quite sure what's going to happen in the middle, because the characters kind of dictate what's going on in the center of the book. Just as long as I get to the ending, then I know. So,
some that just know the ending. They just start from, they say, I know what the ending is, and then they get instructed backwards.
Right. It's like teaching history. Start from today and go backwards. You know?
Hey, you know, I'll tell you something else you raised that's interesting about writing and block and everything like that. Is describing your characters. This was an interesting little fun exercise that really wasn't intended as an exercise, but I had a screenwriter that came to me early on and wanted to, do a screenwriting effort associated with cinema. And the approach was, who of the people you know today, who would you pick to play the part of the William Parker? And he sent me a list of names, and think about that. I mean, who would you do? I mean, Daniel Craig has been taken, so he's out of the equation.
Sean Connery's dead.
Sean Connery's dead. And then my character is a marathon runner, and it's interesting. The guys that have run marathons, Ryan Reynolds has run marathon, which is interesting. But it, you know, that sort of gives you an idea too about, you know, how do you create this character, and what is your image of this character? I remember Lee Child, you know, there were a lot of people upset with Lee Child when Tom Cruise, you know, did Lee Child's books, because he, you know, Cruise is a very dedicated actor to his craft, but he was not Jack Reacher.
He's not even close to Jack Reacher.
No.
You know, so sometimes it works. You can flip somebody out, put somebody else in there if they got a lot of talent.
Well, they use Cruz for draw.
Yes. You know? Oh, yeah. 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 So. His box office guarantees to produce a certain amount of people to come in the door.
I totally get that.
Yeah.
Richard?
Actually, I was going to ask you, since we're talking about different things that you do to get a book started, have you ever had a book grow from just writing, having a scene pop up in your head, a single scene, maybe 3-4 minutes long, and that scene has grown into a full-length novel? Have you ever had that happen?
Well, I tell you, two things I'm working on right now that are potential novels, which are interesting, and they're nonfiction, is that I wrote for a short two-page article for a website called We Are the Mighty about a Navy submarine chaser in World War II that was called the PC-1236, I believe. And it was the first Navy ship that had an all African-American crew, an all black crew. And they chased submarines in the North Atlantic. So, and that little short piece story, which is nonfiction, really gives you an idea for what you could do on a story like that in a larger piece. So, I mean, because there was a lot going on in that story, a lot of behind the scenes in that story. And then I've got another one that I'm working right now that involves women that served in the American Red Cross in World War II.
Oh,
which,
wow.
I was raised by an aunt who served in the American Red Cross, and she was in London during the Blitz, and then she was in occupied France when the forces moved forward. And there's such an incredible amount of stories that I'm just biting at the bullet to sit down and start writing this novel. Among other things, is they were famous because Eisenhower allowed the American Red Cross to have trucks that would do donuts and hot coffee for the morale of the troops.
Right.
So these women, American women in the American Red Cross, would follow the movements. Well, sometimes by taking the wrong road, they got ahead of the front lines. So you got this canteen driving along a French road, and they are 10 miles ahead of Allah. Yeah, exactly. You know. It'll be probably a fiction based story, but it's going to be really have a nonfiction basis to it.
Right. And those gals, just like Vietnam, were known as donut dollies.
That's right. They sure were.
Yep.
Yeah. And one or two of them got bronze stars. I think 52 of them were killed in World War II.
Oh. Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of untold story about them.
You know, there's so many women. There's so many stories about World War II that have yet to be told. And it's you know, I just would like to see more books come out about World War II, because there's a lot of people that are still around. Well, not a lot, but some that have stories to tell. And growing up in Del Mar, we had a guest house in the front of our house, and there was a guy who lived there. His name was Parks, or the Doc Parks, and he was on the Bataan March.
Ah, wow.
And he had some stories to tell when he drank.
Right.
Which is pretty common for a lot of those guys.
Yeah,
sure. At least you hear the stories. Like I said, with my aunt, I regret it. She passed before. The way I found out about this, after she passed, I was going through her closet, and I found her letters home to the South from occupied France and from London. And geez, I mean, these things are so powerful. She was talking about she was in France, and that they still had a person that would at the evening be the French caller, you know, that would walk the streets like something you would see out of medieval times. And you know, how she talked about how this person would come down and say, "The time is 6 o'clock," and you know, such and such.
Right.
You can't make up stuff like that.
Right, right, right. Ms. Bell, have you a question?
I have a question that's really sort of off topic, but I would love you to think about how you might answer it. Sure. If you could be mentored by a famous author, or maybe you'd love to just sit with one, who would it be and what would you talk about?
Well, Good question. Are we talking about both alive and dead?
We can suspend the belief it could be anybody live or dead.
Now, remembering right. that he's sitting here talking to Richard and I.
Well, besides
we're stroking ourselves here. Go ahead.
Well, there you go. I really, when I started doing this thing, I said I want to improve my character description. And so I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop Summer Festival and wrote some stuff there. And they said, well, you need to go to this program and get an MFA in North Carolina. So I obtained a literary fiction master's in North Carolina. So that really exposed me to the Hemingways and, you know, Faulkners and things along those lines in terms of the writing skills and things along those lines. You know, if he were still alive, I'd love to sit down with Pat Conroy. I mean, he could turn a sentence like no one else I've ever seen. You know, the guys that I do know, I have sat down with, Lee Child, David Morrell, are very generous folks. And I had a chance to sit down with those guys. But I'm open to suggestions. If you guys have room, I'll come out to California.
Well, we sat down with John Sanford.
Yeah.
There you go.
And he was phenomenal. He was just the nicest man.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you know what? We have one more commercial we got to get through, and then we'll be right back with you. So don't go away. You are listening to LA Talk Radio. We are on the air with our guest tonight, Mr. Andy Arp. And we'll be right back after this brief message from Creative Edge Publicity. At Creative Edge, we are a team and a community, says Mickey Mickelson, owner of Creative Edge Publicity. The entire organization believes strongly in collaboration from the authors to myself and down to key partnerships we've developed. Mickey is passionate about working in conjunction with his clients and finding more innovative and creative ways to ensure that each represented client has promotional and marketing success, be it podcasts, TV, or live radio interviews. Creative Edge Publicity is your edge in getting your work known. Go to www.creativeedgepublicity.com or write to Mickey@creativeedgepublicity.com. It's your future and your work. Don't trust it to an amateur. Creative Edge, your key to success. And we are back with our guest, Mr. Andy Arp. And in the 5 minutes we have left, Andy, we are almost out of time. Guys, kick it up a notch. Richard, I know you've got something. Oh, I know one thing. Question you wanted to ask.
Well, it kind of circles back to the book, but I'm going to phrase it so I don't do spoilers. You, at the end of this book, reference a certain disappearance. And I'm curious to see how you're going to juggle how you've set this up, given that we've recently discovered things connected to this disappearance. So I'm trying to figure out all the time how writers are going to work out what they're setting up. So I'm curious, how are you going to explain what we know as our reality with what you set up at the end of this book?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Okay.
The story, the story parallels another story. Parallels another story, and it sort of gives thought as to what happened in the other story.
Okay, because I've already figured out three ways you could do it, because that's just how my mind works. I'm thinking he could do this, he could do that, he could do this.
Right.
So I'm.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing, this world of satellites and GPS and everything, that the aircraft can disappear.
Yeah.
You know, you think that everything is accounted for, but it's a big world out there.
Right.
You know, especially we get out in the southern part of the Indian Ocean. It's a lot of water, you know, so, and there are a lot of islands. And right. So, I mean, you just don't have all the answers to all the questions.
Yeah.
Right.
Which makes for a great thriller.
It does.
Right. I loved how you made the earthquake the actual hero of the end of this story. I'm gonna yeah. just give that one alert. If you guys, you were making mention of the whole time about the Teutonic plates and, you know, and but about the tsunami.
You thought I was just spending time.
Okay,
I thought we were
done with that, but no, we were not.
Yeah, that was the hook. I'm happy you caught the hook.
Well, I mean, you planted those Easter eggs very well.
Well, yeah, it was a little bit like in Greek theater, there's this term, the doue machina, which is about the coming of a god that sort of enters the story.
Right.
When it seems like, how is this ever going to get all resolved? And sort of a god enters, and, you know, I thought, oh, that's so cool. How he's using He's using that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, Andy, we're going to have to call it because we're out of time. But you know what? When you finish this next book, man, set up with the bookie, come back and visit us. We have so much more to talk about with you.
You're very kind to have me.
Oh, we would love to have you back if you would like to be. It's going to be next year, but, you know, come back and see us.
Plus, we want to see how he tops Will. We want to see how he tops Will Parker coming down off of a mountain 17,000 feet up in a snowstorm.
Yeah. Yeah. Dragging a body halfway down.
Yeah, there you go.
I like it. Okay. Let us know where, would you please tell our listeners where they can find you on the online?
Yeah, absolutely. AndersonHarp.net. When we started all this thing, my PR people said somebody stole AndersonHarp.com. So I refused to buy AndersonHarp.com. I had a protest. So it's AndersonHarp.net. And I'm at, write me to it, author.andersonharp@gmail.com. So, and we got a pretty active Instagram account as well. So I think it's aharp at Instagram. So I'd love to hear from folks.
Well, like I said, we'd love to have you back on. Your book is available, of course, through Amazon and all online booksellers. Yeah. And off your website, because I was there today. So please come back and visit us. Thank you so much for joining us tonight. I know it's tough being late where you are, but you're a trooper, and we thank you.
And thank you for having me.
Oh, it was our pleasure. And next week, Bobby Jean will not be joining us. She will be out on a mission of her own. But Richard and I will be talking about Black Dog Publishing and Tuscany Bay Books, and talking about getting books published and the editing process and just everything that little writers need to know, new writers need to know. So join us next week, 7 Mountain, 6 Pacific, and 9 Eastern, and, you know.
All that good stuff.
We'll go through it.
And if anybody has any questions about publishing, next week is the time to call in and ask us.
That's right, because we will be able to answer your questions. So for Richard, for Bobby Jean, myself, Sam Hassan, the owner of LA Talk Radio, who has graciously has us on his station, and of course the bookie, without whom we could not have this show, we are out of here.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.